Welcome to this week's edition of Far West Texas. Readings from the Big Bend Sentinel, the Monahans News, and the Fort Stockton Pioneer, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
Hello, this is Michael, reading the Big Bend Sentinel on February 10th, 2021. Marfa Clinic gets additional shots for those skipped over during mass vaccine event by Abby Perot. While a mass vaccination event in Marfa on Tuesday successfully put 500 vaccines into the arms of area residents, dozens of people left disappointed when doses ran out before their afternoon appointments. The event was run by Midland Memorial Hospital, which brought Pfizer vaccines and a handful of vaccinators for the one-day event. Marfa Clinic workers volunteered to assist, setting up the 500 appointments by painstakingly finding individuals eligible for the COVID-19 vaccine. The city of Marfa offered up the USO building as a venue, and elected officials and staff from the city, the clinic, and Presidio County volunteered time to ensure the event ran smoothly. At its morning start, the event was so well organized, said Marfa council member Buck Johnston, who volunteered at the event. 8 vaccination stations were set up, and patients arrived in 5-minute increments. They filled out forms and received their first dose of Pfizer's vaccine. But the efficiency turned out to be a problem. The event was moving so quickly that medical staff were seeing downtime between patients. At that point, the hospital urged local officials to contact people with appointments and request they arrive earlier, according to Marfa City Manager Mandy Roan. Hospital officials just said we weren't moving fast enough, Roan told City Council at a meeting Tuesday night after the event. County Emergency Management Coordinator Gary Mitschke was asked to send out a reverse 911 call and text, urging residents with an appointment for the COVID-19 vaccine to come to the USO building. Shots could be administered earlier than your appointment time, the message told residents. Elvira Hermosillo, a 33-year-old Presidio resident who teaches English to adults, was eligible for the vaccine because a previous brain tumor qualified her as having a pre-existing condition. Hermosillo got the reverse 911 text message at 11:55 a.m., but she was unable to go early. I work and I have a 3-year-old son, she said. She had already arranged for a babysitter so she could make the 1-hour drive to her 2:25 p.m. appointment. The reverse 911 call ultimately caused more confusion, triggering a flood of people who didn't have appointments to show up, thinking there were extras, City Manager Roan said. The city wanted to stick to the appointment schedule, Roan said at the meeting, but they couldn't override the decision by Midland workers who were handing out paperwork to anyone that arrived. People were getting vaccines on a first-come, first-served basis, regardless of their eligibility under the state guidelines. Roan and Marfa Clinic workers tried to grab anyone with an appointment and put them ahead of those who didn't. She counted the pages of remaining appointments and informed the vaccinators that the number of people on the list outnumbered the rest of the vaccines. Hermosillo arrived on time for her vaccine that afternoon, but it was too late. Every vaccine dose had already been administered. She was turned away by Marfa police officers stationed at the doors of the USO building. I felt confused because nobody gave me an explanation, she said. First, she felt shock and disbelief, but then I was angry because I made the drive up to Marfa for nothing. I didn't think it would be a problem, Hermosillo said. I had an appointment. As the vaccination stations were disassembled and carted out of the building a little before 3 p.m., James Jackson, 71, pulled up in Marfa after driving over 100 miles one way from his home near Terlingua. He had had some reservations about the vaccine, but heard Marfa had the shot available and booked an appointment. Like Hermosillo, he was turned away with little understanding of what had gone wrong. Midland Memorial Hospital was unable to return a request for comment before press time. Ahead of the event, a representative said the hospital was looking into the option of having more of these one-day vaccine clinics depending on the need for one, but also depending on the state's allocation of vaccines. Those allocations, the spokesperson said, would be a determining factor in whether they will return for more first-round vaccinations. The hospital is currently scheduled to return on March 2nd to give second-round vaccines to those who were vaccinated this Tuesday. While Fort Davis and Marfa received staffed events from the hospital, Presidio's Preventative Care Health Services Clinic was instead given 400 Pfizer vaccines from Midland Memorial Hospital in late January. It was fewer than Marfa's 500 doses, despite having a population nearly three times the size. Still, PCHS clinic staff was able to successfully administer those shots, along with additional Moderna shots to Presidio residents between January 30th and February 2nd. Between that week and the following week, we did over 1,000 vaccines for the first and second dose, PCHS CEO Linda Molinar said. Before the Marfa event, Hermosillo was already somewhat disillusioned with the vaccine rollout process. I felt like here in Presidio, we always get treated like second-class citizens. The clinic here told us they had no idea when they'll be getting more vaccines. So we feel here in Presidio, nobody considers us. Molinar said the clinic isn't sure at this point when they will be given shots again. Despite requesting vaccines through the state system multiple times over the past weeks, PCHS has not had any of those requests fulfilled. The attempt to get vaccinated in Marfa left Hermosillo even more disaffected. I think what really upset me was the idea that Presidio always gets overlooked, she said. It's not even an idea. That's our experience. She's now considering driving to Pecos, 3 hours from her home, to get the shot. At the Tuesday night city meeting, Councilmember Johnston said, "I don't want Marfa Clinic in the city of Marfa to take this hit. That was not the plan. The plan was not followed, and we're sorry." After learning he would not be receiving a shot on Tuesday, Jackson, the Terlingua area resident, stood outside the USO building. "I don't blame anyone," he said, "but I just wish I hadn't driven all that way for nothing." On Wednesday, Marfa Clinic worked with Midland Memorial to secure additional doses for those whose appointments weren't fulfilled on Tuesday. "We're calling all of our 60 people who failed to obtain their vaccination yesterday, and we're going to distribute them on Friday," said Don Culbertson of Marfa Clinic. After Capitol riots, feds raid home of Alpine Man, by Stephen Paulson. The FBI, last Thursday, raided the home of Alpine resident Sean David Watson. FBI agents were assisted by a number of other agencies, including both Alpine Police and U.S. Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives. The FBI declined to offer details on the incident, except to say they were present conducting a law enforcement activity in Alpine. However, in an interview with CBS 7, Watson said he was proud of his involvement in the January 6th storming of the U.S. Capitol and that he felt like he was fighting for my country. Watson works as a lab technician at the Big Bend Regional Medical Center in Alpine, a hospital spokesperson confirmed in an email on Monday. His precise involvement in the Capitol riots is unclear. At press time, no formal charges have been filed against him in the federal court system. Watson could not be reached for comment, and an ATF spokesperson did not respond to requests for comment. The Alpine Police Department declined to comment, instead referring questions to the FBI. APD did assist with the FBI at their request. Alpine Police Chief Robert Martin said in an interview last week, "I can neither confirm or deny anything." He stressed that the incident was part of the FBI's investigation and referred any follow-up questions to them. In an interview with CBS 7 last week, Watson acknowledged that he participated in the storming of the U.S. Capitol. "I was one of the people who went inside the Capitol building," he told the station. Five people died as a result of the riot, including Brian Sicknick, a Capitol police officer who was injured by the rioters. In his interview with CBS7, Watson also offered more context on last week's raid on his home. "They came and banged on the door," he said of federal agents who arrived last week with a search warrant. The FBI ultimately carted off several devices, including computers and a cell phone, according to Watson. He acknowledged that the raid was likely related to his recent trip to Washington, D.C. Watson's home, if not Watson himself, is already well known outside of Alpine. Last year, he covered his house with conspiratorial messages, including COVID-1984, "Take your masks off," and "Democrats stole the election." He also put up banners with similar messages, including one mocking Biden and suggesting he suffered from cognitive decline. Photos of the house went viral on social media. Nor was last week's raid Watson's first run-in with authorities. The day before the Capitol riots, on January 5th, Watson was arrested after he crossed a police line at a Black Lives Matter protest, he told CBS7. If Watson is ultimately charged for his role in the Capitol riots, he won't be the first Far West Texan to face legal troubles over the incident. Jenny Cudd, a former mayoral candidate in Midland, was arrested last month after she posted a social media video describing her participation in the protests that day. "We didn't vandalize anything," Cudd says in the video as she chuckles. "But we did, as I say that, we did break down House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's office door and someone stole her gavel." Cudd later retracted part of that statement, saying that she was referring in general to rioters and not herself specifically when she described what "we" had done. Former sheriff's candidate charged for allegedly lying to FBI. Devin Portillo is facing up to 5 years in prison after the FBI says he lied to them, by Stephen Paulson. A former sheriff's candidate in Brewster County is facing federal charges after the FBI last year said the phone number of Brewster County Sheriff Ronnie Dodson was spoofed to send offensive messages. Phone spoofing occurs when someone uses technology to make it appear as though a text or call is coming from a different sender. The candidate in question, Devin Portillo, a Republican, was charged last month with making a false statement or representation after he allegedly lied to FBI agents who were investigating the spoofing of Dodson's phone. When agents asked Portillo whether he had created the spoofed text, he said no, according to court documents. While spoofing is sometimes a crime in the United States, Portillo has not apparently been charged for the actual spoofing. Instead, he faces a charge for lying to the FBI, which was looking into the matter. The FBI says Portillo allegedly knew he had created the fake text message and therefore made a willingly false statement to federal authorities, according to court filings. If convicted, Portillo faces up to 5 years in prison. Portillo made an initial court appearance last Friday at a federal courthouse in Alpine. A follow-up hearing is tentatively scheduled for March, and by press time, he had not yet entered a plea. At his hearing last week, Portillo agreed to a $10,000 surety bond, meaning that while Portillo did not have to pay the $10,000 to secure his release, he will be on the hook for those funds if he violates his bond. Portillo agreed to a number of conditions as part of that agreement, including abstaining from all alcohol and agreeing not to travel to Mexico. He was also ordered to promptly report any contact with law enforcement and to remove all firearms from his apartment in San Angelo. Portillo did not respond to a request for comment on the charge. His lawyer, Stephen Spurgeon, declined to comment. Sheriff Ronnie Dodson declined to comment in detail on the incident, citing the fact that the case was still ongoing. But Dodson did say he was pleased to be vindicated in this incident and said he wanted the public to know he did not send out any offensive or racist text messages. "I'm glad this part of it is over," Dodson said in a phone interview on Monday. "I didn't want people to think I had done what was done." Portillo's political troubles, and later his legal ones, started last summer. Around June, an online petition started circulating after tweets from 2013 on Portillo's Twitter account resurfaced. The tweets in question used the N-word, along with derogatory racial stereotypes. The petition, which ultimately garnered more than 5,000 signatures, said that Alpine does not condone racism or discrimination. It asked that Portillo be removed from the sheriff's ballot. In an interview with the Big Ben Sentinel at the time, Portillo blamed sabotage for the tweets and said his account had been hacked, or that the offensive tweets had been otherwise doctored. At that point, the tweets were no longer on Portillo's Twitter profile. The Big Ben Sentinel found evidence that the tweets were posted in 2013 and therefore could not be part of a recent political hit. When presented with this evidence, Portillo declined to comment. "We're not commenting on anything else," Portillo said in a follow-up interview last year. However, he did acknowledge that he had authored another controversial social media post in which he wrote that American soldiers fought in international conflicts so that we can live freely, and not so man can lay with man. Just days later, the FBI confirmed it was investigating after Sheriff Ronnie Dodson's number was spoofed to also send out racist text messages. While the Big Ben Sentinel does not know details about the content of those messages, a spokesperson for the FBI said they were racially insensitive and hateful in nature and were sent to several members of the community. The agency also said it could verify that none of the offensive messages originated with any of Sheriff Dodson's devices. In a social media post at the time, the Brewster County Sheriff's Office said that Sheriff Dodson had filed a criminal complaint for identity theft and threatening a police officer. Dodson did not condone any of the language in the messages, the post said. In a phone interview at the time, Dodson said he had to temporarily stop using his phone after he started receiving call after call after call, complaining and threatening him for the racist messages. He called the situation horrible and warned that phone spoofing technology was dangerous. Portillo, whose candidacy never quite recovered from the controversy, ultimately dropped out in August. A write-in candidate, Alpine police officer Will Draw, replaced him on the ballot. Unfortunately for Portillo, there's no option to drop out when it comes to the new federal indictment against him. Sol Ross looms large at Gutierrez Town Hall by Stephen Paulson. New state senator Roland Gutierrez held a virtual town hall with constituents last week, including those in Alpine. The conversation covered a range of topics, from rural broadband and COVID relief to one of his hallmark issues, cannabis reform. Looming large in those conversations, though, was a proposed bill that Gutierrez filed last week. That bill, as the Big Ben Sentinel previously reported, would move Sol Ross University from the Texas State University system to the Texas A&M one. The bill caught some Alpine residents off guard, but at his town hall, Gutierrez reiterated his reasons for filing the bill. Sol Ross was struggling under the TSU system, he said, and could be better served by A&M. He also stressed another point he made in an interview last week with the Big Ben Sentinel, that far from being an out-of-thin-air bill, he had discussed the proposal for years, including with Alpine Mayor Andy Ramos and Brewster County Judge Eleazar Cano. Since the Big Ben Sentinel went to press last week, more officials have spoken out about the transition. In an email to the Big Ben Sentinel, Eddie Morales, the new state representative for Alpine, said he was discussing filing a companion bill in the state house, but needed more time to read through the bill and discuss it with constituents. Morales is planning a town hall for this Saturday, February 13th, with more details to be announced. At the virtual town hall, Judge Cano also confirmed that he and Gutierrez had previously discussed the proposal. "I support you, Roland," he said. "You're doing the right things by asking the right questions." The bill made sense, Cano said, because regardless of the outcome, it would allow residents and officials to look behind the scenes on issues like enrollment and funding and make some hard decisions. But to be clear, Gutierrez's bill is about more than transparency and cost cutting. It would transfer Sol Ross from TSU to A&M. Feelings on the bill were mixed at the meeting. Josh Lira, a recent student at the SRSU-affiliated Rio Grande College, thanked Gutierrez for the bill. He said RGC had suffered from a deficit of important resources, including no childcare center for parents and a lack of educational materials. The student body included many young mothers who needed childcare options, he said. We had no available and accessible library, he said. We had no books in our library. Even among the detractors, concerns seem to have more to do with the apparent suddenness of the bill than with any particular allegiance to the TSU system, though there was community support for University President Pete Gallego. Jack Cooper, an Alpine resident and Sol Ross alum who had previously written to Gutierrez about the bill, stressed that Gallego was new to the job and had so far been serving the community well, including with COVID testing drives last year. I'm not saying I'm for or against your bill, Cooper said. I'm just saying, why can't we hold off your bill through COVID? In response, Gutierrez reiterated that he had discussed the proposal for years and said he aimed to be a transformational leader. I don't know if I'll die tomorrow, Gutierrez said. Time is fleeting. The Texas legislature meets for just a few months every 2 years, and a large majority of the bills introduced each session never get passed or even see a vote. It remains to be seen what will happen to Gutierrez's bill, much less to the future of Sol Ross. But regardless, one thing is clear. Whether Sol Ross stays part of TSU or moves to A&M, Gutierrez had no plans to change the name. I have no intent on changing the name, Gutierrez told constituents. If some of you believe we should, well, I apologize. Last year, as Black Lives Matter protests rocked the country, SRSU saw a student-led movement to rename the school Alpine State University. Activists cited Lawrence Sullivan, Sol Ross's involvement in slavery, the Confederacy, and what Texas Monthly recently called a massacre of Comanches at Peace River in 1860.
Hi, this is Jack. I'm reading the Fort Stockton Pioneer, dated Thursday, February 4th, 2021. Capacity increased to 75% by Nathan Hoor, Pioneer editor. On Monday, February 1st, Pecos County saw the economy take a step in the right direction, as restaurants, bars, and indoor facilities in the county are now able to hold up to 75% of their capacity, according to the governor's orders. The capacity limitation was previously at 50% since the county went over the 30 active case threshold for a consistent period of time starting towards the end of October. Texas State Governor Greg Abbott later added a hospitalization rate stipulation in November when the pandemic caused a spike in active cases and hospitalizations. Pecos County Judge Joe Schuster received the news unexpectedly early this past weekend after a week of expecting a need to place an out-of-station request in order to get to the 75% capacity limit. The order from the governor was due to the fact that the county has had 30 or less active COVID cases since January 21st, marking 12 consecutive days under the 30 threshold, as well as a hospitalization rate. Hospitalizations are in line with active cases. Pecos County Memorial Hospital has had at least 15% of their beds open in that same period of time for non-COVID patients, for elective surgeries and inpatient treatment for other illnesses and injuries. The hospital must maintain that threshold in order to not put the 75% capacity at indoor facilities at risk. As of Tuesday, February 2nd, there are 3 suspected COVID patients hospitalized, well below 9, the number the hospital needs to stay below. There are 6 additional COVID patients that are hospitalized statewide. Sol Ross State may move to A&M system. On Monday, February 1st, Texas State Senator Roland Gutierrez filed Senate Bill 522 to officially move Sol Ross State University and its associated Rio Grande colleges from the Texas State University system to the Texas A&M University system. Gutierrez stated, "The negative direction of Sol Ross State University is a regional problem affecting more than a dozen West Texas counties. After speaking with the community at length and having thoroughly researched Angelo State University's vast improvement after joining the Texas Tech University system, moving Sol Ross State University is the right decision for the institution, the students, and the faculty, and both Alpine and West Texas as a whole. As president of Texas A&M University, Lawrence Sullivan, Sol Ross was known for saving the college from closure and expanding campus facilities. It's time that we bring Sol Ross State University to the larger A&M University system, where there is a synergy across several major areas of study, including range management, veterinary science, energy, and archaeology. Sol Ross State University and Rio Grande colleges have experienced a long period of declining enrollment numbers, posting new lows this fall semester. Combined enrollment totals from Sol Ross and Rio Grande campuses in 2009 was 3,063 students. In 2019, the combined headcount was 2,465, a decline of nearly 20% in just a decade. Its larger West Texas counterpart, Angelo State University, has seen enrollment rates skyrocket from 6,860 in 2010 to 10,568 in 2019. Sol Ross has languished in the Texas State University system and is failing to pull its weight financially. Gutierrez aims to turn that around by joining Sol Ross State University with a university system that has a reputation for rehabilitating and improving institutions. The Texas A&M system has made successes out of universities it took over in Laredo, Corpus Christi, Canyon, and others. Gutierrez continued, "Texas A&M has an excellent record of providing its students with a world-class education, whether they are in College Station or Cutter. Texas State University system is an outstanding system run by a chancellor whom I respect very much, but my first priority must be the people of the 19th Senatorial District. I have the utmost confidence that this will give Sol Ross State University and Rio Grande colleges the stimulus we need for those institutions to grow and prosper." Sol Ross State University is a staple of West Texas and the embodiment of our commitment to education for all Texans. It is named after Lawrence Sullivan Sol Ross, who saved Texas A&M University from financial struggles and expanded the campus as its president. It is only fitting that Sol Ross State University return to its spiritual home in the TAMU system. Texas A&M has a strong chancellor system with great experience in the funding process. Sol Ross students will be locked in to the TAMU system for years to come. Recruiting and retainment becomes easier due to association with the A&M brand. Sol Ross students will have access to a more robust network of resources. In 2007, Angelo State University joined the Texas Tech system. Though larger than SRSU, ASU is still a rural college in West Texas that faces many of the same challenges. Still, ASU has fared better over the past decade, growing its student base and retention rates. From a geographic standpoint, this is a move that makes sense. A&M is no stranger to rural communities and small cities. The TAMU system thrives off its rural enrollment and has resources in place to support West Texas. Chief complaints, such as physical distance between SRSU and RGC, are more easily addressable. Necessary amenities such as Wi-Fi and bookstores can be shored up easily with a robust TAMU system, and with better communication between Alpine and the satellite campuses. Fort Stockton designated as COVID-19 vaccine hub. Congressman Tony Gonzalez sent a letter Monday to the Texas Expert Vaccine Allocation Panel requesting to designate Fort Stockton in Pecos County as a COVID-19 vaccination hub. As we continue to combat the coronavirus pandemic, we have to ensure that even the most rural areas of our district have the same access to the vaccine as those in our cities, said Congressman Gonzalez. Designating Fort Stockton as a vaccine hub would allow us to disperse the vaccine more quickly and efficiently. Full text of the letter is as follows. Dear Expert Vaccine Allocation Panel, I respectfully request that Fort Stockton, located in Pecos County, be designated as a COVID-19 vaccination hub. As the pandemic spreads across rural areas in Texas, I am concerned that key portions of my congressional district do not have adequate access to a vaccine. This is especially true in Trans-Pecos, a region comprised of 8 counties with a population of 55,000, excluding El Paso. Designating Fort Stockton as a hub would strategically connect Pecos County, the most populous in the area, with the surrounding Jeff Davis, Reeves, Presidio, Brewster, and Terrell counties, and provide an alternative hub for Huspeth and Culberson. Fort Stockton's convenient location on the Interstate 10 highway would enable easy transit among these counties. The Pecos County Memorial Hospital already serves patients from neighboring areas, and Fort Stockton has the resources and commitment of the county, city, school district, emergency management coordinator, and EMS to administer vaccines quickly and efficiently. I realize Reeves County has been designated as a hub and fully support their efforts. However, given the population and distance from one town to the next, this region would be better served by 2 hubs. Thank you for your dedication to promoting a healthy Texas. If you have any questions, please contact my district director, Michael Blair, at 210-806-9920. Sincerely, Tony Gonzalez, Member of Congress. Mama Won't Fly opens February 19th. Fort Stockton Community Theater announces its next production, a comedy, Mama Won't Fly, by Jesse Jones, Nicholas Hope, and Jamie Wooten. The play will open Friday, February 19th at 7:30 p.m. at the Nelson Street Theater. There will be a barbecue dinner theater prepared by Friends of FSCT on Saturday, February 20th at 7 p.m. On Sunday, February 21st at 2 p.m., there will be a matinee followed by 3 nights of performances on Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday, February 22nd through the 24th, each at 7:30 p.m. Reservations are required as seating is limited for social distancing. Call Alice Dirksen at 336-3180 for reservations. Prepaid reservations are required for dinner theater. Reservations may be made at Fort Stockton Chamber of Commerce. The deadline for dinner theater is noon on Monday, February 15th. Reservations for the other performances will be taken till seats run out. The slapstick comedy is directed by Alice Dirksen and stars, in order of appearance, Pam Palaiologo, Penny Smith, Michelle Salazar, Kirby Warnock, Tracy Alexander, Michelle Huckabee, Aurelia Hall, Dean Dirksen, Frank Lacey, and a mystery guest star. Audiences will enjoy watching Pam, Penny, and Tracy drive across the country to get to California for Tracy's wedding because Mama won't fly. The other cast members each play 3 or 4 different characters that the ladies encounter on their journey. J.B. Gallegos, Jared Hall, Aurelia Hall, Dominic Leiva, Cole Mitchell, and Vicky Mitchell make it all happen behind the scenes. It's an evening of wacky costumes, silly jokes, and weird characters that all ages will enjoy. Plan now to attend at least one of the performances by calling 336-3180 for reservations. Pecos County People, A Family Affair, Barbecuing, A Shared Passion, by Nathan Heuer. Who's the best barbecuer in Fort Stockton, you may ask? Fort Stockton native Jimmy Stevens might just be your guy. And his sons Aaron and Brian, who now live in Midland, might just be right up there with their father. The three don't claim to be, but the product speaks for itself. In 2008, the Stevens entered a different realm of barbecuing when Jimmy and his oldest son Aaron decided to start competing in barbecue cook-offs around the state. My son and I entered our first competition in 2008, Jimmy said. I particularly like to go and meet people and have a good time. My philosophy on it is if I win something, that's just icing on the cake. For his sons, they have more competitive fire when it comes to cooking barbecuing at cook-offs. Brian, who is the youngest, is out to win every competition he enters, according to Jimmy. My youngest son, he's in it to win, Jimmy said. He works real hard at the house trying to perfect his cooking and stuff like that. Aaron is more involved than what I am, but not as involved as his younger brother. Brian added his thoughts on the activity they are all doing. It is an expensive hobby, he said with a smile. While level of competitiveness varies, they can all agree on enjoying the experience while doing something they're passionate about, around the people they love. I'm really grateful that both of them have taken up cooking, Jimmy said. We have a great time at these events together. The father and his sons entered their first competition of 2021 on Friday, January 29th and Saturday, January 30th at the West Texas Cook-Off in Odessa, an event hosted by the International Barbecue Cookers Association. Jimmy entered a pair of jackpot competitions, margaritas and chicken wings, while his sons cooked chicken, brisket, and ribs. Jimmy won the competition for the best margarita, while Brian placed in the top seven for both ribs and brisket. We had a lot of fun. It was a great time, Jimmy said, after a 12-hour day at the Ector County Coliseum. Next up for Jimmy and Aaron and Brian is an event that means a great deal to each of them, the Richard Reeves Memorial Cook-Off. Jimmy started the event in 2019 to help raise money for the Richard Reeves Memorial Foundation, an individual who was a good friend of the Fort Stockton native. Richard Reeves was a little bit older than I am. He was a senior when I was a freshman. He graduated in 72, and I graduated in 75. He was a good friend, but his son and my sons were real good friends. They made everybody a little bit closer. Reeves passed away in 2004 from leukemia after being diagnosed a few years earlier. His son Nathan started a fishing tournament shortly after to raise money for the memorial he started to help raise money for those in need with medical hardships and the expenses they incur because of them. Nathan began a golf tournament not too long after starting the fishing tournament. In 2019, Jimmy decided to host a cook-off in honor of his late friend, raising money for the Richard Reeves Memorial Foundation. I'm real passionate for the Reeves Memorial and what they do. I told Nathan I was going to put together a cook-off, and he said, it's your deal. I'm going to lay this in your lap, he said. Our first year, it was the state championship. We had 53 cookers. We have a $20,000 prize. We paid 15 places in each category, which gives a good opportunity to pay a lot of people. That means a lot of people are traveling 500 miles. The cook-off raised $9,300 for the memorial in 2019, and after a cancellation due to the pandemic in 2020, the Pecos County native hopes to raise even more money this March at the event held at Rooney Park. We're hoping we have a better turnout with all things considered with the pandemic, Jimmy said. The Richard Reeves Cook-Off is currently scheduled for March 18th to the 20th at Rooney Park in Fort Stockton.
Hello, I'm Jesse. I'm reading from the Monahans News for Thursday, February 4th. Lawsuit against Village Farms settled. The story was written by Paul Cyphers. A lawsuit filed last year by a Village Farms employee in Monahans alleging the firm did not adequately protect its workers against the coronavirus, has been settled before trial. In the settlement consent decree, Village Farms agreed to several policies, including notifying workers of possible exposures within 24 hours, allowing exposed workers time off for free COVID testing, offering housing for workers in quarantine, and promptly reporting cases to state health officials. The lawsuit, brought by Monahan's facility worker Maria de Los Angeles Calzada Navarrete, alleged the company wasn't doing enough to provide safe housing to workers or quickly notify them of possible COVID exposures. Navarrete was represented by Texas Rio Grande Legal Aid, a nonprofit legal assistance group in Mercedes, Texas. Darren Gemmel, Vice President of Human Resources, Administration and Compliance for Texas Operations of Village Farms, said in a Tuesday interview the company was implementing or had already implemented those policies at its facilities near Marfa and Fort Davis, as well as Monahan's. However, in a January 15th news release, TRLA stated, quote, "The consent decree resulted from a federal lawsuit Texas Rio Grande Legal Aid filed on November 20, 2020, on behalf of an employee at the Monahan's Greenhouse, Maria de Los Angeles Calzada Navarrete of El Paso." Quote, "Village Farms deserves credit for coming to the negotiating table quickly and agreeing to implement the measures we requested," said TRLA attorney Maxwell Desmukes, who represents Calzada Navarrete. The release also stated, quote, "According to the suit, Village Farms had refused to implement simple, obvious, and cheap measures to protect its employees' health and safety during the pandemic." The press release goes on to say, quote, "The suit asked the U.S. District Court in El Paso to require Village Farms to quarantine sick workers, notify workers who have been exposed to sick workers, provide access to free testing, and report positive cases to public health authorities," end quote. The agreed order was issued by U.S. District Judge David C. Guadarrama of El Paso. According to court documents, Village Farms is required to provide isolation housing in Monahan's for workers who test positive for COVID-19, provide separate quarantine housing in Monahan's for symptomatic but unconfirmed COVID-19 cases. Village Farms may no longer send workers who are symptomatic for COVID-19 back to housing shared with healthy workers. Make best efforts to notify all employees who have been exposed to COVID-19 within 24 hours of exposure. Arrange medical appointments and provide exposed employees with time off work and transportation to get a free COVID-19 test. And promptly report positive COVID-19 cases among its workforce to the regional director of the Texas Department of State Health Services. Village Farms took exception to the press release statements about the consent decree. "It suggested that the company was being forced to protect workers," Gemmel said. Quote, "The only thing we weren't doing was providing the quarantine housing in Monahan's. We had that taken care of in less than 24 hours. We have a 30-year reputation of taking care of our employees." Quote, the release from TLRA also said employees were told to return home to quarantine if they tested positive for COVID. That is not true at all. Employees have always had that option, but we have not required it. Quote, from the time COVID outbreak started in March, we never had a case until September 9th. From that time until the end of the month, we had an outbreak of 11 cases. We took immediate actions, and there have been no active cases since, Gemmel said. Village Farms has requested that TLRA have the news release either partially or fully retracted. Robert Elder, a spokesman for TLRA, told the news, quote, there are no plans to change or retract the release, end quote. In a separate update, in a July 4th, 2019 story in the Monahans News, Village Farms had announced plans to convert the Monahans facility to growing hemp to be used in the production of CBD oil instead of tomatoes and cucumbers. Village Farms CEO Mike DiGiglio told the news at that time that the company had hoped that guidelines and regulations would be completed by state regulators in the fourth quarter of 2019 and production would commence when those guidelines were completed. But as of Tuesday, those regulations were still not forthcoming from the state. Quote, "We're still growing tomatoes," Gemmell said. Number of COVID-19 cases declining. The story was written by Paul Cyphers. As of Wednesday morning, there were 85 active cases of the COVID-19 virus in Ward County. A slight increase was noted over the weekend, with 74 cases reported on January 29th, peaking to 98 on Tuesday. That number has since dropped to 85. In total, the county has had 618 confirmed cases, 423 probables, 927 recoveries, and 16 deaths. But region-wise, County Judge Greg Holly said things are improving on his Wednesday Facebook update. Holly said, quote, "The numbers seem to be improving in our region in line with what we're seeing locally." According to a news article yesterday, during the virus peak in West Texas, Midland and Odessa's health departments were seeing around 80 or so positive cases a day. Lately, that number is down to about 8 to 15 cases a day. That source, Newswest 9. Quote, "I also saw an interview with the CEO for Medical Center yesterday, who said their hospital numbers are significantly lower than a couple of weeks ago. That's in line with our hospital, where we have had only one patient with COVID-19, as opposed to 8 to 10 just 3 or 4 weeks ago." Quote, "All of this is good news. We will likely continue to have ups and downs for some time as the vaccine is more widely distributed, but I'm grateful for what we're seeing right now." Statewide, Texas has 367,000 active cases, 2.1 million confirmed cases, 308,000 probable, and 36,870 deaths. Plana booked for sexual assault of 23-year-old. This story was written by Christy Sullivan. A Florida man has been arrested on a Ward County warrant of sexual assault, a second-degree felony, as the result of an investigation by the Monahans Police Department. Johan Plana, age 26, of Florida, was arrested by United States Marshals and transported back to Ward County on January 27th. Monahans Police Department Captain Christopher Quintana said, quote, "Officers were dispatched to the 300 block of North Carroll Street on Sunday, August 23rd, around 6:18 a.m., in reference to a call of a sexual assault," end quote. At the time, the 23-year-old victim identified Plana as the suspect and said that she and Plana had been acquaintances and were drinking prior to the incident. Lieutenant Kynes located Plana, who had fled the scene by the time of the call, and tried to obtain a statement from him, but he declined to comment. Plana did tell Kynes he would be returning to Florida later that day. On August 28th, an arrest warrant for Plana was secured, and Monahans Police enlisted the help of the U.S. Marshals in detaining Plana, Quintana said. It is not clear exactly when marshals arrested Plana. Plana posted the $25,000 bond and was released on January 28th. The offense can be punishable by imprisonment in the Texas Department of Criminal Justice for any term of not more than 20 years or less than 2 years, and a fine not to exceed $10,000. Legality of vaping policy questioned. The story was written by Paul Cyphers. A notice was sent to parents of Monahan's high school students using the Zip Slip application on February 1st that stated, quote, "Due to the increase in students vaping in the classroom, students will empty their pockets prior to entering the restroom. Thank you for your support." End quote. The Zip Slip program automates everything involving paper forms and transactions that go between parents and their child's schools via electronic devices. Questions have arisen if this policy constitutes an illegal search. According to the Texas ACLU, a letter was sent to school superintendents that stated, quote, "Arbitrary searches of students not suspected of wrongdoing not only violate the Constitution, but also conflict with a core Texas value, the right to be left alone by the government. While the unique role of education in our society is a factor to be taken into account in assessing the reasonableness of this search, it does not necessarily outweigh all other factors. Some articulable facts which focus suspicion on specific students must be demonstrated before any school search can be carried out. Quote, without specific evidence of drug use or a real and immediate threat, schools may not subject students to such searches." End quote. District Superintendent Chad Smith, who was not available by phone, had not replied to an email as of Wednesday morning. In questioning this policy, Monahan's Wicked Pyote ISD Chief of Police Orlando Orona said, quote, "I have nothing to do with this. It is outside my area of responsibility. It's up to the administration." End quote. Monahan's Police Chief Billy Riley said, quote, "I'm not involved with what the school is doing, and I don't really know what they are doing, but an illegal search is an illegal search." End quote. The Sandstorm Goes Digital. The story was written by Christy Sullivan. It's been a long time coming. The Monahan's High School newspaper, The Sandstorm, is being revived, this time in digital form. The publication can be seen at https://thesandstormnewspaper.squarespace.com. Students will write the content for the digital newspaper and keep the site updated with the supervision of their teacher, Hope Mora. Mora, who began teaching art, photography, and journalism at Monahan's High School at the beginning of this school year, has been a media arts educator for 5 years. Quote, "I was teaching time-based art at the University of Buffalo before moving back to West Texas," she said. At MHS, the student-developed newspaper, which was published every 6 weeks for years up until 2010, had always faced challenges when it came to actually putting it out. Not only in the amount of time that goes into laying out pages, but also the cost of printing and the lack of personnel to teach the class were some of the reasons for the print editions to be terminated, Mora said. Quote, "I used to work for the Pecos Enterprise in Pecos, and I have to say I really love printed material, but sometimes you have to work with what you have. So we decided to revive the Sandstorm as a digital platform," Mora said. The online version of the Sandstorm made its debut February 1st and now serves as MHS students' source of articles written by their classmates. The month publication is easy to navigate and will eventually include other topics like student life, community, sports, academics, and opinion podcasts. With the Sandstorm making the digital move, the newspaper is more accessible to students and cheaper to distribute, Morris said. Quote, "I think accessibility is so important. It's cheap, and we can reach a wider audience. Not only those at MHS, but the Monahans and West Texas community. It's also a great way for students and faculty to submit events, writing, and art to contribute. This platform is inclusive and a place for students to represent themselves, she added. As of right now, the Sandstorm staff is comprised of three: Mora, MHS senior Catalina Bejaran, and junior Angelina Blanche. Quote, "This semester, in my digital art class where I teach journalism as well as audio editing for podcasts, we are a team of three. I expect this class to grow later, but for now, we are accomplishing so much already. Both of my students come to class every day with interesting ideas, humor, and good energy. That's what makes this work," she said. As far as Mora's feelings on this new development for the newspaper and the process she and her students have undergone to carry it out, Mora said, quote, "I feel so grateful to have the opportunity to work with students on an important project and contribute to MHS culture. Besides my experience as an educator, I am a visual artist. I primarily work in video and photography, and my work is about and for communities. So working on the Sandstorm newspaper brings me a lot of joy. Our process is really just about getting to know everyone and asking lots of questions. We use class time to interview, photograph, and transcribe notes. I help out with web design and editing their stories. Catalina and Angelina also take initiative outside of class to interview people. I think that's the nature of journalism. You're working no matter where you are, especially if you are enthusiastic and curious," end quote. If something isn't covered that readers would like to see in the next issue, Mora said, quote, "they would love a contribution," end quote. Contact or send submissions, MHS Happenings, Art, Writing, Music, Stories, Opinion, to hmora@mwpisd.esc18.net.
Thank you for joining us for this week's edition of Far West Texas. This is the Recording Library of West Texas, enriching the lives of individuals with physical, visual, and learning disabilities since 1963. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.